Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 24th, 2002. In the fireside room this morning is Cynthia Molabita, and the title of the session is Globalization and Luther's Economic Ethics. The session number is MOC 2002-09. Let's listen in.
For the sake of the taper, let it be known that this fifth session is beginning. This is indeed the fifth in five sessions examining neighbor love in light of the globalizing economy. We have worked together now rather intensely, and I would suggest that we have dared to look at realities from which we would much rather flee, and from which we all do flee at certain times. Perhaps it is the case that we are being driven into a wilderness in which we hear the call to love neighbor as self today in our context. And our context is the context in which our neighbors are global and are intimately wrapped up in our lives, by virtue of the way we eat and drink and clothe ourselves and work and transport ourselves. Perhaps we are being driven into a wilderness in which we see that we are called to love those neighbors, and in which we see that our very lives are death-dealing in certain ways. Perhaps we are being called to live as if the way in which we eat and house ourselves and clothe ourselves and transport ourselves and work and play, that is our economic lives, as if our economic lives are, as Luther said, acts in relationship to neighbors. And therefore, they're normed by, the guiding principle is, they will serve the neighbor's well-being as well as serving the needs of ourselves and our families. If we are being thus called, I share with you my firm conviction that not one of us is called to go that way without also being empowered by God to go that way. God doesn't call God's people where God doesn't empower us to go. And we are empowered by a number of things. We are empowered by God's presence, in Luther's words, making habitation in us. Christ making habitation in us. Making us God's hands on earth. As Luther said, what other hands does God have on earth? We are empowered also by the presence and power of God coursing through all of creation. So spend the next year hearing and seeing the presence and power of God, as Luther said, present in every creature, even the tiniest leaf. It seems to me that we are empowered also by the gifts of eyes and ears and brains and hearts. We're given eyes and ears and brains and hearts so that we can devise ways of life that do serve neighbor love. When I was commissioned as a missionary in Honduras, the commissioning verse was the one that says, be shrewd as serpents and gentle as doves. Is that how it goes? And being shrewd as serpents, in a certain sense, means to me using the incredible gifts that we have of perceiving and thinking and feeling to devise ways of life not yet devised on this earth, because humanity hasn't been faced with what we are now faced with. Using our tools, our incredible gifts, the gifts of education and of intellect, to be a part of the vast movement on every continent of this earth today of people to, quote unquote, restructure the global economy. So let us spend time now, most of our time, looking at what it might mean to live as if. What it might mean to live as if we are part of restructuring the global economy towards sustainable earth-human relations and towards economic life as neighbor love. Let's pop that overhead projector back on again and go back to where we were yesterday. And would someone be so kind as just to remind me when we have 10 minutes left? That would be at 11:35. Because I'd like to, when we have 10 minutes left, just situate this all in another resource, which is just the resource of ways of thinking in Christian ethics. And it's just the top half that we're looking at here, righto, this part. Thank you so much. Now, I guess we better turn the lights on a little bit. Maybe someone who's sitting right back there could pop those lights down a little bit. What I've thrown out here is four overall principles. Could you take a look at those? And particularly, let's take a look at maybe the first two. Can everybody read that? Can't read it? Anyone can't read it? Hold up their hand. Oh, one can't. Let me quickly read them aloud then. The first is that the aim of economic life is to be just, sustainable, participatory communities and earth community. Oh, I bet now we can read when the lights are going down. Okay, good. Then I won't reread. If you were to think, just to imagine, to think in as-if terms, if our economic lives were governed by those principles, what are some public policies that might live those into being? I mean, be pragmatic here. Public policies that might be right in your own town, Wenatchee or Seattle, or might be in your country, U.S., or might even be international policies and practices, policies that you've heard about. Any thoughts, any ideas?
First one, labor standards.
Pardon me?
Labor standards.
Meaning, say a little bit more?
Meaning that as far as just goes, that would be a policy that if you were thinking in terms of the aim of economic life is to be just, that certainly would come to mind for me.
And what do you mean by labor standards? Just say
meaning,
something.
Meaning, you know, you don't, there's a certain age and a certain number of hours that you're allowed to work.
Okay. And a certain amount of pay?
Yeah, wage.
Like a livable wage?
A livable
wage. Is anyone familiar with the livable wage movement? Okay. In the back row?
That would also include, unlike our current welfare reform, that would include that daycare costs are, that the living wage doesn't include a huge amount of daycare costs, because it isn't really a livable wage.
So in other words, you're saying that not only a livable wage, but also
needs met, such as daycare, such as medical, such as things that are, you know, in there, should be part of a safety net.
Okay. Excellent. So let's say let's imagine that our church communities, does everyone here belong to a congregation, a church community? Let's imagine that a community of which you are a part, a church community or another, is deciding to spend a year dedicating itself to exploring the mysterious terrain of living as if. One of the things that might take on is activism towards living wages and towards daycare for people who don't have enough money to pay for it. What happens though, what if a local grower is going to start paying truly a livable wage, say to migrant workers, and making sure that, a livable wage and making sure that there are benefits. What's going to happen to that local grower?
They're going to have a hard time not going out of business because they're not going to be able to compete very well, most likely, with the others who are not changing their practices. And so when you go to the grocery store and you have a choice between apples for 60 cents versus apples for $1.50.
Is that real, folks?
Yeah.
If you decide to pay migrant labor a livable wage and how are you going to survive in the global economy? I mean, say you're growing apples. There's apples coming in from Chile that are going to be a lot cheaper. Or there's apples coming in from another grower locally that are going to be a lot cheaper. So what is another step then that in a practice that would support that policy? If a policy is we're going to work towards livable wages, what are practices that would support that policy?
Well,
yes. I worked for as a food advisor for WSU,
Okay.
Extension, and we used to tell people to buy locally, buy seasonally, and buy fresh, and support the local economy. And now there's a big movement, I don't know whether you've seen it in Seattle, but part of Washington, and we were downtown one day and we saw them with these big trays of all kinds of food that are grown in Washington, you know, to try to get people to buy. And sometimes a lot of it's organic, so sometimes you do pay a little bit more for it, but you have to pay for your values.
Okay, it is not natural that we can have incredibly, incredibly cheap food and produce, cheaper than any place else on earth. Someone's paying for that. So maybe it means part of our practice is a consumption practice, and that is starting to pay more for products that are grown ecologically and according to economic justice. That's one of the things being said here. A hand in the blue shirt? I can't remember your name.
Well, I live in Port Townsend.
Okay.
You may all know about Port Townsend, about how they're trying, our city government is trying to keep out the major corporations that are trying to come in. We didn't keep out McDonald's, but Rite Aid and Walmart and all the other big companies, so what we have are these small local companies, which is wonderful. But one of the problems is that if you grow up in Port Townsend, there are no jobs, and people have to leave, because the companies are not in there hiring. And the other problem is that we buy locally, but you can't buy everything locally, so then you have to drive a long ways to get lots of things, which people are happy to do because we're following those values. But it's inconvenient for a lot of young families that don't have a lot of money, that gas, they can't drive an hour for everything you need, and so on. Anyway, there are costs to that.
There are costs and complexities, and to call it simple living is a little bit of a misnomer.
Yeah.
I love the simple living movement, but I wish it had a different name, because it's really not simple to revamp the way you live, but it is possible. Okay, other thoughts. That's one, that's just where we're throwing out possibilities. The possibility that's the policy that's been thrown out is livable wage, and we're looking at how that might bear in our practices, how it might bear out in our practices. Other thoughts about policy moves, local, national, international, yes?
I just have a question. What is the difference? I mean, I know there's a difference between minimum wage and livable wage.
Right, go ahead.
So I can figure it out in my head here.
Yes. The livable wage campaign I know of is in Seattle. Does anyone know what the livable wage standard is being set in Seattle? No, I'm sorry. Does anyone know the state, Ron?
Well, I think in general, in terms of theory, livable wage means that a family of four with two people earning the minimum, but they still are only spending a certain percentage of their income in order to live. And minimum wage, in Seattle, what is federal minimum wage, if two people were working full-time, earning minimum wage jobs in Seattle, they cannot live in Seattle. So livable wage means that minimum wage for people living in Seattle has to be increased to a point that two people earning a full-time living can afford to live in housing and buying food in Seattle. And that may be much higher than minimum wage across the nation.
Do you know what minimum wage is right now? I'm just curious. In Washington.
$6.90
Now, just to throw out something here also, I want to point out the almost eerie consistency between that notion of a livable wage and both Adam Smith, who's the father of capitalism, capitalist theory, and Martin Luther. Smith said you've got to pay a worker enough to support himself, they're talking hymns in his day, where he works, and if the worker is a family, enough to provide an adequate life with dignity for the family. That's a livable wage. Okay, let's go on.
question right here.
Well, just a comment. There were some statistics the other day in the paper regarding eligibility for the food bank.
Uh-huh.
Not food stamps, but the food bank,
uh-huh.
which would be low income. Uh-huh. And King County had 6% mm-hmm. of the population eligible.
Mm-hmm.
The entire state of Washington has 20%. Which is really quite astounding.
Mm-hmm.
And Chelan County here has 25%. Okanagan mm-hmm. County just mm-hmm. north is 18%.
Wow.
And nationwide, Washington has the greatest percentage. It's hard to believe. I mean, you think of Mississippi and I don't know, this is directly from the paper.
Uh-huh, wow.
Oregon was number two at the bottom.
Well, Washington and Oregon now have the highest unemployment rate in the nation, so that's not surprising
uh-huh.
that they go together.
Okay, so again, let us take these kinds of facts into consideration, and let's put our minds here thinking that in our community, in our faith community, we're going to dedicate a year to entering into a mystery. And it's the mystery of claiming that we can move towards economic life that serves the well-being of neighbor. We're thinking about principles that could guide that. We've thrown out a few of them. Now think about more public policies and more practices of life, and third, more acts of public witness that could move us that way. In the back, Ron.
From another angle, I would move towards much more progressive taxation and graduated property tax.
What do you mean by progressive taxation?
Well, in the state of Washington, we don't have income tax, so we're considered one of the most progressive tax states in the union. But in most, there's a statement in our state constitution that says in any geographic area there's a flat rate for property tax, and yet you have people earning, in King County, $4 billion, and people earning $4,000, and yet they're paying the same flat rate for their property.
In King County?
In King County, and if it were graduated, the person paying, that has a $17 million home would be paying much more property tax than a person who owns a 17.
Okay, so say, is that right?
Yeah. Well, they're paying more. The person with the much more expensive house is still going to pay a much more out of pocket. But I think what you're saying is that they would be paying a higher rate of tax.
Yes, a higher rate.
Not a higher just amount, but
the
right rate.
Right. Good. That is what you're saying, and good clarification. You opened my ears to what he was saying. What's a practice that could lead towards that? I mean, one simple little practice that I've seen is writing letters to the editor towards that. It's astounding how there aren't a lot of editors, letters to the editor asking for us to pay more taxes. Someone called our house one day about a political figure who was running for office, and they started talking about how this figure was going to lower taxes. And I said, well, we're in favor of basically raising taxes for a lot of people, including us in some ways, and the guy was just dumbfounded. But taking stands around taxation would be one public policy and one set of practices that could lead a different direction. Others.
I think Bill Gates and a lot of millionaires had a big thing about they didn't mind paying more federal taxes, they were talking about, and that Bush keeps wanting to lower the taxes for the upper 1%, and that these people all came to and said, no, we want to pay these taxes,
Well, that's very, very interesting. That I want to use that to point to a fascinating resource, because indeed you're right. There are movements amongst very, very, there is at least one movement I know of amongst very wealthy people to look at reversing this increasing gap between the rich and the poor. Using that as a little segue to one resource, and you've asked for specific resources, there's an organization called United for a Fair Economy. I brought one of their resources here, and because I don't have the address at hand, you can look it up on the web, on the internet. United for a Fair Economy.
that is promoting a number of policies and practices, and one of them is, amongst, within United for a Fair Economy, is a network of very, very, very wealthy people. And one of the things that they are looking towards in terms of public policy is a maximum income level also. The notion that the highest paid cannot earn more than a certain than a certain multiple of what the lowest paid earns. In other words, today it's, I think it's the highest paid CEOs earn, what is it, 470 times what the lowest paid workers, or lowest paid workers live. So another public policy move would be that that's not only minimum wage but a maximum somehow in terms of percent, in terms of times. Why can't I say this better? That 470 is too big.
But the ratio of the pay that the lowest paid to the highest paid should be not exceed a certain level.
Yes. So that's another public policy move that is fomenting in circles of the very, very wealthy through through this organization called United for a Fair Economy. That is a resource that we could all plug into, that organization. Okay, throw out other policy thoughts, yes.
How would that work for people who don't get a salary, like Gates?
Now, how that would work specifically and logistically is a great question I don't know the answer to. But it's a question worth pursuing, and the one route through which I know to pursue it is to plug into that organization. Because that organization is organizing around that proposal. How it would work specifically in detail, I truly cannot tell you the answer. Let me throw out a couple of other things that I have become aware of in working public policy ideas that I have become aware of in working with various people here and around the world. Getting back to some of our looking at international issues. We've talked about economic growth and the fact that economic growth has produced grand income for many and has not for many others. In South Africa, an economic coalition composed of faith-based groups, Christian groups, and led, in fact, for some time by a Lutheran theologian and economist, is proposing pro-poor growth, so that economic growth be pushed for. They're pushing for economic growth, and that it be pro-poor and pro-environment. Pro-poor economic growth would mean growth that brings jobs for poor people, and that serves to increase the well-being of those who are poor, not just the well-being of those who have money and access. Pro-environment growth would be growth that in the long run doesn't deplete environmental resources. Here's another one. There's a movement afoot to worldwide, and it's being really organized, pushed most fully by a coalition of Christian groups in Europe. Has anyone heard of the Tobin tax? It's a movement worldwide to tax speculative investments. So if you invest in the short term, if you buy currency in the short term investments that make that put money into countries and pull it out very quickly would be taxed, which would minimize, remember that clause that we were talking about in the MAI that would ban any prohibitions on money moving in and out of countries? This would do the opposite. This would make it less desirable to invest speculatively for short-term gains. And it's a very concrete movement afoot. I'll bet you that it will enter into, you'll hear about it in the next year. I bet you $100 that in this country, in justice-oriented church networks, we'll start talking about Tobin-like taxes. Tobin was a Nobel Prize winning economist who proposed this tax, and now there are many versions of it, so we talk about Tobin-like taxes. So for us to take the practice of supporting, asking our legislators and senators to work towards Tobin-like taxes would be a way of mitigating against the devastation that comes through speculative investment. Remember when I read you the words of the Korean theologian who talked about what had happened in Korea because of speculative investment? This would be a way of addressing that issue.
And you're talking specifically about investment in currency in particular.
I think Tobin tax is looking at, Tobin-like taxes are looking at investment. I don't know exactly what they're doing beyond currency investments.
Because we already have, the short-term, short-term gains tax versus long-term gains tax in the United States, where you do have to pay a higher tax. You don't hold your investments as long, but that's something that already exists.
Yes. And Tobin-like taxes would actually, what they would do is tax certain forms of short-term international investments, transnational investments, and the income from the taxation would go into a fund that would promote development activities in the poorest of the poor countries. Now, I'm not giving you the details on that because I don't have with me all of the details, but again, if that was a piece of what you wanted to take on in looking towards living as if, all you need to do is plug into Tobin tax in the internet and start unlocking a vast wealth of resources for activism around that issue. Any thoughts, other principles or policy or practice thoughts? I'll throw out a few more, but I want to see what you've been musing about first. What if this one, economic policies and practices are to aim at a system of commerce and production where each and every act is ecologically sustainable and restorative? Think about that in the long term, meaning that whatever we do is not ecologically depleting, but is restoring. And remember, this is being, here's another resource. Paul Hawken is the person I've quoted there for that principle. He's the author of The Ecology of Commerce. Excellent book about the contributions of business toward restructuring the global economy. One of the implications of that might be that in the long run, as we see our lives for the next decade or two, as we see our lives on behalf of our children, that our society moves from a carbon-based society to a renewable energy-based society. What would be some policies and practices that might move us that direction? And I submit to you that we already are underway. There are parts of U.S. society moving towards, plowing ground, forging paths toward no longer being a carbon-based economy. Can you give me any examples? Yes.
I know, I was watching some show and they passed a law in California that said that, by some date all cars had to get a certain gas mileage. And it was a ludicrous law because there was no way. But the outcome of it was that gas mileage has improved and there was a certain percentage of electric cars now or hybrids that were used. So even though they didn't reach the goal, they made strides toward it, in which, had they not passed the law, then it wouldn't have happened.
That's an excellent example. And California has indeed passed a law into the future. I think it's 2010. A date by which a certain percentage of the public fleet, we're talking public fleet, what's public fleet? It's school buses and police cars and everything else, has to be, a certain percentage of the public fleet will be non-carbon based energy. So if California is a bellwether state, kind of leading the way in certain things, whether they be good or bad, that's an interesting sign and an interesting thing to pursue. Has anyone read about Ford Motor Companies? I think it's Ford, one of the big motor companies. Incredible development activities, research and development activities right now around non-fossil fuel-based cars.
Well,
One thing that I've
yes.
know is that the technology is already there to create a car that runs on water. I mean, the steam. The technology is already, we can do that, but the implications of doing that, I mean, you can just imagine fossil fuel industry and all these things, kids, it would just be chaos. So that is being kept very hidden right now, because if that was released, well, it would really cause chaos. So
if you mean if we turned more towards non-fossil fuel-based transport?
Yeah, the technology is already there. I mean, that's kind of the thing that I'm saying, is that we can already do it. And create it, but I mean, it's going to cause a huge ruckus if you do it.
You mean like a kind of ruckus that we don't have to fight any more wars for oil? That kind of ruckus?
Right, but I mean, there's tremendous
vested interest in maintaining a fossil fuel devouring society.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Right.
And there is. Now, a sign of awesome hope is what you just said, that the technology already exists to be much less a fossil fuel desiring society. So if the technology exists, then what is required is the political will.
Right.
The economic. Okay, thank you. The economic and the political will. That is, people who want to restructure the global economy pushing towards the utilization of that through our activism, perhaps our public witness. But that very fact that the technology exists opens a door for those of us who want to move towards living differently. Thank you for bringing up California back there. Other examples of movements, public policies, practices? Let me throw out a couple of other resources then to feed our inquiry into living differently. One is something I believe I mentioned earlier. This journal or this organization called Co-op America, you might jot down, it sounds like less than it is. It's not only about co-ops. It's a journal that comes out, I believe, every 2 months. And lo and behold, in this journal, it's quite a sophisticated guide to many forms of economic activism toward a more just and sustainable society. It includes, they print a whole plethora of resources about socially just and economically sound business. So you could decide to buy food and clothing and other necessities from businesses that are taking the vast risk to operate in socially just and economically sound ways. That's no small risk. As we said earlier, that's the risk of going out of business. This is a journal that gives resources into socially responsible investing. How many folks here have looked into socially responsible investing? So that's another practice, and it's a practice that a church community could decide to investigate together. If a church community was going to decide we're going to live as if one person who knows investment activities could take on the act of researching socially responsible investing and advising. Maybe you have an investment advisor in the church. Another person could take on the task of socially responsible eating and could look into consumer, provide resources so that everyone doesn't have to look into everything, but different people could be different fingers on the hand of living as if, and different people take on different responsibilities and share them with the whole. This journal is just a grand resource, a tool. Another tool I wanted to show you that I'm less familiar with, but I instinctively see as very useful, is a journal called Yes. A Journal of Positive Futures. It's the journal that comes out of an organization. Has anyone read When Corporations Rule the World by David Corton, or heard David Corton on the radio. It's a journal that comes out of an organization called Positive Futures. And all you would really need to do is look at this journal afterwards and write down the address. It's located in Seattle, or in Bainbridge Island, actually. And it's full. It has pages of ideas about both public policies and practices that lead toward economic justice. So those are two resources to throw out there. What would be practices of, just let's, what would be practices of worship? What would be practices in a faith community that could help lead a faith community toward practicing economic justice? Many of us in here are Lutherans. According to Luther, the liturgy after the liturgy, a part of the liturgy, a part of God worship, of God's service, is reshaping, is service to those who are in need. That intimately involved with the liturgy is service to those who are in need. The Eucharist, and for Luther, it's not only service to those who are in need, it's challenging systems that oppress those who are in need. The Eucharist, when you read Luther's Eucharistic writings, he claims that the Eucharist changes us into a community of love in which first our needs are served and then we serve the needs of others. Can you imagine the Eucharist having that kind of power? Just close your eyes for a minute and imagine that the Eucharist has the power to change us into Christ coming to us in the Eucharist. Changes us into, as he says, a communion of love. We take on the burdens of the other. The others take on our burdens. And we go forth with a capacity to build economic justice. Play around with that for a minute. What form might Eucharist take? What might happen in the Eucharist if we were to claim that power? I don't have an answer I want to, so I don't want you to. Any ideas about that? Open the eyes again. Any thoughts? Luther at one point says that in days gone by, I wish I had the quote with me. I'll find it. While you're thinking, let me just find this quote for a minute. Okay, what comes to your mind if you think about the Eucharist having that power? Yes.
I don't have an answer, but I'm imagining, and I'm not sure how you all experience communion, but our way of doing communion is very internal.
Huh.
And inward focused, however we do that, it's all, you know, just in our liturgy is God and us as an individual, and then if we're really good, then we connect with our own community at the end, but it's all facing inward. Maybe some part of the ritual would be then a facing outward, or a language that like you're talking about, where we're in touch with God within and with our community, but then there's something that connects us out where we lead.
Somehow that the Eucharist would enable us to see out, to see both the presence of the living Christ and outward into the world, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay, thank you. Karen?
Yeah, I'm thinking too of how can we be reminded of the outside community, and
some of the visual symbols that I see in the Village Center, old village, like the beautiful cross that has the squares that were made from in El Salvador. If we incorporated some kind of visual reminder into the area in which the Eucharist is taking place, so that as you approach to be part of this meal, that you are reminded of the greater community that you are made part of. And it could even be, you could cycle through different visual symbols of people in different places, or your church could adopt for a year a focus on a particular country to do study sessions on it, and maybe do some pen pals and get some artwork and incorporate that in.
Okay. Fascinating. Thank you. Ron?
I think following the model of being a welcoming and an affirming congregation, also being welcoming and affirming to the very poor. You know, our tendency is to keep them out, you know, and to go from inside out rather than inviting them in. And until they are part of our communion, we're going to continually experience that divide.
Okay. That's another powerful shift in what we see as integral to communion, to the Eucharist. Alex.
And not just, and maybe this is speaking to the choir and it's obvious to everyone else, but to have that kind of new vision, paradigm, and openness, not just in the Eucharistic portion of the service, but in the spoken word, and maybe sometimes incorporating litanies of confession and absolution that speak to that, so that as a person preaches and as the other parts are done, more opportunities for seeing what needs to be, hopefully then changing our behavior.
Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting thought. I'll tell you, when I started looking at Luther in economic justice and realizing the extent to which he talked about people being changed towards, not being made perfect, none of this business, being empowered to love, I asked, why? Let me take a step back. Let me read to you just a couple of things that he says. Could we do that? And just muse upon, close your eyes and muse upon the Eucharist. He says, these are in his Eucharistic writings, "The sacrament, that is the Eucharist, has no blessing and significance unless love grows daily and so changes a person that he is made one with the others. Thus, by means of this sacrament, all self-seeking love is rooted out and gives place to that which seeks the common good of all. When you have partaken of this sacrament, therefore, or desire to partake of it, you must in turn share the misfortunes of the fellowship. Here your heart must go out in love and learn that this is a sacrament of love. As love and support are given you, you in turn render love and support to Christ's needy ones. So as you uphold all of them, and they all in turn uphold you." And then he says, "In times past, this sacrament was so properly used, and the people were taught to understand this fellowship so well, that they even gathered food and material goods in the church, and then distributed them among those who were in need. This has all disappeared." This is Luther. "And now there remains only the many masses and the many who receive this sacrament without in the least understanding or practicing what it signifies. They will not help the poor, put up with sinners, care for the sorrowing, suffer with the suffering, intercede for others, and defend the truth." When I asked Luther, when I was reading Luther, and I thought, why in the dickens does he make these claims about the Eucharist? And we go on and practice the Eucharist, and it doesn't seem to have that power. And then I also read a Lutheran theologian from, I can't remember where, I think the Philippines, who was asking the same question.
And what I read is that Luther also says that one of the practices that empowers us to live the love of Christ is the Eucharist. Another is prayer. And there are places where he says, and I'm almost exactly quoting, why don't people serve the poor? It's because they don't pray enough. So prayer is utterly integral in that, and that's just saying, I would take a minute to look for it. Why don't they this and that? Surely it is they do not pray enough. So there's the power of prayer. Thirdly, in his writings, more implicit but very clear is the sacrament of solidarity. That in solidarity, meaning in serving, not only serving the needs of the poor, but he admonishes preachers from the pulpit to preach against economic injustice. How many of you have heard people in churches say that preachers shouldn't bring economic justice into the pulpit? Has anyone heard that?
Yeah.
All right. Well, Luther admonishes preachers to preach against ways of economic practices that elevate, that serve, that build wealth for the wealthy and on the backs of the poor. Very specifically, he does that. Three of the practices that he says empower us to live the love of Christ: Eucharist, prayer, and solidarity. And solidarity, in his terms, is denouncing economic injustice and is producing systems that take care of the welfare of the poor. So that suggests to me that the power of the Eucharist is mystically interwoven with the power of solidarity, and that maybe one of the reasons that we don't experience that power in the Eucharist is that we're not practicing solidarity. Maybe when we practice solidarity and don't also practice deep, deep, intimate communion with God through prayer and Eucharist, we just burn out. You know, maybe these three practices are intimately wound up together.
You wanted to know when you had 10 minutes left?
Thank you.
You have about 7.
Thank you. Could we just make a little shift here then? I do want to say we've been talking about many things, and hopefully they are seeds for going further. I want to affirm the fact that all of us who are Christians in this room, who claim that our lives are fed by the love of God known in Jesus Christ and the Spirit, that all of us are theologians. And all of us are Christian ethicists. In other words, we, in one way or another, are pondering and making sense of God and how we are to live. And that the more we make that conscious, the more powerful we are. Christian, I'd like to challenge you all to think of yourselves as Christian ethicists. And that is very simply to think about who we are and how we are to perceive and live in the world because of God's boundless love for creation and presence in and with creation. Just to see ourselves as disciples of Jesus Christ, we are Christian ethicists. That is, we're to think about who we are and what our world is in light of that boundless love of God as the overarching reality. Another way of saying that is just to, the way I see it, is that ethics is the task of seeing two things very, very clearly, more clearly for the rest of our lives. One is the world in which we live, the political, economic, cultural, ecological realities of the world. And that's what we've been doing in these sessions. And secondly, seeing the mystery of God with us and for us, with creation and for creation. Seeing those ever more clearly and holding them together so that the intersection of those is what shapes our lives. Doing that
is amorphous and cloudy, but beautiful and mysterious. There are six questions that I like to use, that I like to teach, that help us put some flesh on that. Could you pop this overhead up a little bit? And I wanted to just share these questions with you, and let you, you know, put them down and then see how they work in your lives. Oh, I guess there are five. I had six. Five questions I've put that constitute deep, this is for a different purpose, that constitute inquiry into globalization. Actually, these are the questions of economic, of Christian ethics. And the first question is simply, what is the case? What is going on? That's the first question before us as Christian ethicists. That's what we've been working on in these classes. There are a few keys to asking that question. And if we had more time, we'd dig into them. But I want to give you one. One of the keys to asking that question is always to challenge what is assumed to be normal or natural or inevitable or God-given. So as you go through daily life, for the next week, challenge what is assumed. Not by challenge doesn't mean to overturn it. It just means to question it. What is assumed to be natural or inevitable? I think we assume it to be sort of natural that some people will be homeless on our streets and some will be very, very wealthy. I think we assume it to be sort of inevitable that we're going to be building pipelines to get more oil out of Alaska. Just challenge whatever is. Remember, it's what has seemed natural or divinely mandated throughout history. Those assumptions have supported incredible oppression. Give me one example. Put flesh on this natural normal.
Women are just lesser creatures than men.
Women were by divine mandate and by nature lesser human beings than men. Another example.
Slavery.
People of color were by nature and by divine mandate. Some of the strongest writings justifying slavery were theological writings. By divine mandate and by nature and by inevitability, people of color were lesser human beings. That had to be challenged. Someone had to say, wait, is this really natural? Is this really divine mandate? Yes?
Animals are still lesser.
Okay, now there's another one. We assume by nature and divine mandate that we are the pinnacle of creation, and until recently we've assumed theologically that creation, the rest of creation, is there to serve us, animals and everything else. Now it's time to challenge that. And by challenge, again, I don't mean overturn, I mean question. So the first guideline for asking what is the case, or in other words, for seeing more clearly the earthly realities around us, is challenging what is seen to be natural, normal, inevitable, or divinely mandated. A second guideline is hearing the voices from the margin. Whenever we're investigating any political or economic reality or ecological reality, listen to the voices on the underside, those who stand to lose. And our perceptive eyes will be opened. Those are just two guidelines to go with that question. Skip this one and go to this. The next question is, what could be? What are alternatives? What could be? It's the second question of ethics. You can see I'm mixing my numbers up. A third is, what ought be? What are the moral norms that guide us? And what I've thrown out to you here is that two moral norms are an age-old one, justice making neighbor love, and the second is a much newer one, cast upon us by the imperatives of our time and place, and that is sustainable earth-human relations. The fourth question, what forces disable our moral spiritual power to move toward what ought be? What forces disable our capacity to move toward faithful, subversive change? And we've been talking about some of those forces. We've been talking about ideas. Ideas about growth, ideas about freedom and democracy. You could probably list 30 or 40 things, if you began to think about what disables the moral spiritual power that we have. And then the fifth question, what are sources of moral spiritual power? How are we empowered in our path toward living as if? And in this case, as if economic life served neighbor love. It seems to me, and again, in a normal period of time, I would truly ask you to name for me those forces, the disable and the enable. But given the constraints of our time, let me just throw out that some of the enabling forces, some of the sources of moral spiritual power are, that I find, are one, seeing clearly, making a commitment to see, listening to Jesus when Jesus says, have you eyes but fail to see? Getting lenses of capacities to see what's going on, which again is what we've been working on in these days. Secondly, seeing in community, working towards restructuring the global local economy, working toward living as if in community. It is never to be done alone. Third, giving voice to what you see and hear. And fourth, being in, practicing solidarity with those on the margins. And fifth, opening the heart and the mind and every fiber of being to the promise that God dwells in us, that Christ dwells in us. I understand those to be five sources of moral spiritual power. I noted when we had, how many were here in the forum on the Middle East two nights ago? There was one woman who made a comment. She said, well, what we can do is start learning more and reading and finding out what's going on. And she sounded like very active and hopeful. And I talked with her afterwards and I said, how is it that when you started hearing and knowing what was going on in the Middle East, between Palestine and Israel, instead of just hunching in and saying, oh God, this is so awful, you are active and empowered? And she talked with me for about 10 minutes, and what it came down to was, one, you know, asking the question, what is the case? See, educating yourself, knowing. But she said she was doing it in a community of six people within a broader community of her church, and they were giving voice to what they were seeing. They were talking. It was controversial, it was controverted, but they were giving voice, and they were acting in solidarity. And I thought, the reason this woman has not become, it's okay if that goes up, has not become disempowered by what she's seeing is because she's in community, she is expressing, giving voice to what she's knowing and seeing, and she is beginning to act. So, as someone who is asking you to see yourselves as Christian ethicists, that being a part of discipleship, I simply throw out to you those questions to have as frameworks for pursuing, and that in asking what's going on, or in asking what is empowering, remember that stepping into this kind of terrain that suggests the possibility that we are called to live vastly differently is not to be done alone. It's to be done in community, and it's to be done claiming that if God calls us this way, then God empowers us this way. And if we are called to be body of Christ on earth, then let us believe that we indeed are body of Christ, habitation of God on this earth. Let's close formally there, and then we can remain for questions as long as we would like to do so. And also, I want to just tell you that more of this stuff is available if you want to get a hold of this book that I wrote on all of the subject matter called Healing a Broken World. Thank you all.
Thank you.